Yeah, baby, it's episode 141 of Ask the Inspector on Tuesday, March 5th, 2024, or as some are wont to refer today, Super Tuesday. But as our regular viewers know, every Tuesday is Super Tuesday because we do the lightning round of Ask the Inspector every Tuesday. But here in the U.S. of A., many states vote in the presidential primaries and also the lower offices as well. And today, Scott, was the first time in my life that I voted on Super Tuesday because I have never before lived in a Super Tuesday state.
Well, congratulations. Now,
thank you. I mean, you know, it is a good feeling, actually, because the problem with going late in the game is it's already over with. You want to feel like, you know, there's still some reason to vote. Yeah. Not that it's going to make that much difference. Now, I don't know if you're like me. Did you learn in grammar school that who we voted for is supposed to be a secret, very private thing?
Secret vote. Yeah, that's one of the great things about being an American citizen is that your vote is a secret ballot.
Exactly. So don't even try to persuade me into revealing who I voted for. Okay. Gentlemen, got to keep some secrets.
Trump.
I'm not going to tell you, no matter how hard you twist my arm. All right. So we have a new article that was published a couple of days ago on Substack. Holy moly, Scott. The silent eulogy. Please tell me that it was a warning and not a prediction.
Well, I mean, all predictions are warnings until they become true. I would say that we are, when you have Russia saying, if you guys attack us, we're going to nuke you. Straight up. If you guys attack us, we're going to nuke you. And, oh, by the way, a German Taurus missile attack against Crimea is you guys attacking us. So we're going to nuke you. I mean, how much closer do we have to get? We literally, in the West, we are clueless about what's going on. We've allowed Germany, France to hijack our national security. I mean, Germany's sitting there talking about sending Taurus missiles to Ukraine. And attacking the Crimea Bridge. France is talking about sending troops to Ukraine, which would generate a confrontation where Russia would slaughter French troops. France would scream bloody murder. NATO would say, oh, God, we have to come to France. Now we have a war and the world's over. So I will tell you this. If Germany follows through with sending Taurus missiles, then the world's over. If France follows through with sending troops to Ukraine, the world's over. So it's a prediction. It's not just, you know, oh, I'm warning you. It's happening right now as we speak. Macron didn't back away. He said, we're leaving all options open. I mean, this is where the United States literally has to get on the phone and say, stand down, France. You don't have the right to initiate a conflict that you expect us to be a part of. If you plan on initiating this conflict, tell us so we can let the Russians know France is on its own. You can wipe them off the face of the earth. France is doing this unilaterally, no NATO protection. Go forward, Macron, and conquer. And then France will back off because France can't do anything by itself. And I would say the same thing to the Germans. Y'all want to attack the Crimea Bridge? Do it. But we're done with you. Washed our hands, finished. Because that ain't what NATO is about. And the American people need to be demanding. Why isn't Congress holding hearings on this issue? I mean, why are we? So, no, this is a eulogy. We're dead. Unless we stop what's happening, we're dead. Straight up dead.
Well, I will say this. You inspired me and helped me kind of crystallize in my mind the importance of the Waging Peace campaign. And I was working on it a little bit over the weekend, coming up with some language about how we can actually make some progress with this. So that's something to talk about in the coming days. And in the meanwhile, I would like to encourage everyone to go to scottritterextra.com to read this article. And we are now offering couple of t-shirts in women's design, and we're going to give it away again today. If you want to enter a drawing for a free t-shirt, just type in hashtag shirt in the live chat, and at the end of the show, we'll give it away.
Now, we call this one also the Hoffman Cut.
The Hoffman Cut.
And we also have a another version called the Newland Cut. That's the male version. Named after Victoria Newland. He's more a man than Hoffman will ever be. But anyways. Sorry.
All right. That's Fred Hoffman, for those of you who may not be familiar with Waiting for Hoffman. No, that was Waiting for Guffman. Anyway. All right. The Tuesday show is the lightning round. That means Scott answers every question in 3 minutes or less. And we do it for 1 hour. On Fridays is the loquacious version. That's 2 hours from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern time. And Scott answers questions much more extensively. Let's get started. The first question is from Benny Hart in France. We have seen France's President Macron talk about the possibility of sending NATO troops to Ukraine and German military officials talking about helping the Ukrainians destroy the Kerch Bridge with German Taurus missiles. What is Turkey's stance on all this, considering that Turkey has the strongest NATO army besides the U.S.?
Well, my understanding is that what Macron was speaking of is that NATO nations would, on a unilateral basis, that is, without NATO cover, not part of a NATO mission, send troops to Ukraine. So we couldn't really call them NATO troops. We would have to call them forces from NATO nations that are operating in a non-NATO state. And we see precedent for this. Turkey, for instance, when they send forces into Syria, those aren't NATO forces. Turkey, when they send forces over to Libya, those aren't NATO forces. Those are Turkish forces. And therefore, when Russia bombs Turkish forces in Syria, Turkey doesn't get any NATO protection. So I think that's what they're talking about. But the problem is, if France deploys these troops, what happens when Russia decides not just to kill the French troops that are on the ground in Ukraine, but now hold France accountable for what they do? Or a more pertinent one, a more realistic one, is what happens when the Germans, now that we know that it wouldn't just be giving the Ukrainians Taurus missiles, but the Germans would be actively involved in the targeting and the facilitation of the use of Taurus missiles. So the Russians not only target every German troop concentration in Ukraine, but also say, we're blowing up the production facility of the Taurus missile. We're blowing up a German Air Force facilities that are involved in the targeting intelligence facilities. They're striking Germany. Now, will Germans say, oh, my God, we were attacked by Russia, Article 5, and then we go to war? If the world was fair, the rest of NATO would say, no, I'm sorry, that's, you brought that on yourself, Germany. You're on your own on this one. That would be ideal. Turkey's position, this hasn't been brought forward to NATO, so Turkey has no position. These are unilateral decisions that are being made by other nations. Now, Turkey should come out and say they don't support this. I would imagine that would be the Turkish position. But when it comes to NATO, this hasn't been made a NATO issue. It should be brought up in the military council, and it should be asked the question, if France acts unilaterally, if Germany acts unilaterally, and France and Germany are struck by Russia, does Article 5 kick in? And the answer should be no, but we'll see.
All right, we have a voicemail message from a gentleman who claims his name is Jefferson Davis.
I'd like for you to talk about the 1932 Bonus Army, where there were tanks on the streets at the National Mall in Washington, D.C. in 1932. If you will look up that event and talk about it a little bit, I think Americans need to know that America had a Tiananmen Square with tanks on the street moment in 1932.
Yeah, I mean, I'll look it up and read in more detail. But if I'm not wrong on this, the Bonus Army was basically World War One. Well, there it is. World War One veterans. They gathered. Jeff's basically giving me the script as I see it. But they look for Douglas MacArthur actually led the attack or oversaw the attack against the Bonus Army. And it was a a peaceful protest that was violently put down by the United States military. So, yep, that is part of America's history.
All right. Glad to provide you with the script. I'm here to help. Although, you know, somebody complained. They're actually right. I have to cop to it. Somebody said I should listen to the questions more carefully because sometimes, you ask for my help. You said, what'd they say? And I'm like, I don't know. So I agree. All right. Where the hell is that?
I'm going to get whipped and it's not going to be my fault.
No. There we go. All right. Let's move on to the next question. And it is from Sarah in California. Russia is hosting a delegation from Hamas and the Palestinian Authority. Will Russia intervene in Gaza? And what are the possible outcomes of that delegation?
Well, I don't think that Russia will intervene in Gaza. What Russia is trying to do with this delegation, from my understanding, is get Hamas and the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the Palestinian Authority, to come together and create a singularity, meaning one political entity that is responsible for both Gaza and the West Bank. And in doing so, the Russians believe that this would pull the rug out from underneath Israel and the United States. Israel has said that they will not deal with Hamas directly, or they want Hamas dead. But Hamas is winning. They're not losing. They're surviving. And so they're a reality, and the Palestinian people turn to Hamas. So the Russian concept is to get Hamas and the Palestinian Liberation Organization to come together and create a new political entity that can govern both and sit at a table and say, we're ready to talk peace. We're ready to talk a Palestinian state. And Israel would have no choice but to sit down with this entity, and the United States would have to support it. So this is Russia's way to push forward diplomatic solution to this problem.
Okay. The next, you can help me with the clock, Yelena, especially when we stop it. Igor from Los Angeles, California, where I lived for many years, not a Super Tuesday state, California. I would like to hear your opinion about lobbyism in American legislation. In my opinion, the fact that legislators make decisions based on money received can be qualified as bribery.
Look, money corrupts politics. It corrupts every aspect of politics. Citizens United corrupts the vote. There you go, Jeff. And had to throw that zinger in there. If you got money involved, you're automatically corrupt because that's what it becomes about. If you take money out of politics, if you remove money from the equation, then, you know, lobbyists have to fight on the strength of their ideas. Right now, lobbyists fight on the strength of their influence based upon, you know, who they underwrite, et cetera, you know, whose campaigns they finance, where their money goes. And then we find out that the lobbyists that pay the most money or, you know, provides the most, you know, meals or, you know, whatever benefits that you get from hanging out with lobbyists, suddenly you're voting for them, and you're not voting the will of your people. You're voting the will of the lobbyists. This is why, in almost every instance, every American congressman, congressperson, I guess, a representative, and every American senator is already inherently corrupted by the time they arrive, even before they vote on the first law. They've already been corrupted. I saw an interesting show. I forget, it might have been a Michael Moore movie or something, but as soon as a congressperson, a representative checks in, the first thing after getting sworn in is they take him down to a suite of rooms where they have to sit down and start making, they just got elected and they're already have to be on the phone making calls to raise money for the next election, which is only 2 years away. That's all they do is raise money. They call people at home, but they also get supported by, you know, lobbying is the way, so political action committees are the way that you engage Congress. Look, I'll have to dig into it, but if there's no money involved, maybe that's the way, you know, but I want my representatives to be more linked to the people, not to lobbyists. I think anything we can do to undermine lobbyists in Washington, D.C., maybe make all lobbying done at the local level, meaning if you want to lobby your representative, it has to be done. If you want to lobby my representative from New York, it has to be done here in New York, not in Washington, D.C. Washington, D.C. should be sort of a place where our representatives can do the people's business. If you want to lobby this person, then they have to come home here, and it has to be done in a public forum where the people can see. This is lobby day. Hi, this is the guy from Reynolds Tobacco. He's talking. Mr. Representative, I don't want you talking to Reynolds Tobacco. Democracy. You see, that's the way it works. But yeah, no lobbyists. I'm not a lawyer. Bribery is a very specific thing. I don't know how to distinguish between the two, but I just think take money out of it and then we don't have to worry about it.
You're not a lawyer and you don't play one on TV and you didn't stay at a Holiday Inn
Express last night.
Never heard of that commercial. Never heard of it. Of course.
You never did?
You asked me the last time. I heard of it. If I heard of it, that means most people have because I don't even watch TV hardly at all. Louis Mithot or Mitho from Mancora, Peru. Here's an easy one, claims Louis. Why do Hezbollah, Hamas, and Houthis spokesmen have a high-pitched voice? Is it considered virile in the Arab world? Oh, my goodness. That's a provocative question, but you can handle it.
I don't know, Louis. Why are Peruvian doors so short? Is it because Peruvian people are just inherently short? I mean, is that a pretty racist thing for me to say? I mean, it's true. I was in Peru. I was in Cusco, and the hotel I stayed in, I had to duck going through because the doors aren't made for 6'4" people. But I'm not going to sit here and try to categorize the entire Peruvian nation based upon, you know, something. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that so the feds have to listen to Scott.
This is how Scott lobbies his representatives.
I just think this is that question has some racism built into it. I don't care. I'm not going to go there. I just think that they speak the way they speak, just like people look the way they look.
I'm with you, Scott. I shouldn't have even included that question. In fact, let's go to Joe Biden to tell off this guy.
Come on, man.
Thank you, Joe.
Every once in a while, Joe comes through for us. The next question comes from Olya in Toronto. Could you please comment on the death of Boris Nemtsov? I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly or close to it. Being one of the events for which Putin has been demonized, it is hard to find alternatives to Western propaganda accounts about it on the internet.
Well, this is my understanding, and I could be wrong, but this is my understanding. First of all, Putin had nothing to do with Nemtsov's murder. Nothing to do with Nemtsov's murder. But Nemtsov was murdered. There were Chechens who were arrested for this crime. And my understanding is that they had been unleashed by an authority in Chechnya who thought that he was doing Putin a favor. He thought that he had understood Putin wanting Nemtsov taken out. And so he acted on his own volition and he paid a heavy price for that. I mean, he's alive, but Putin held him to extreme account for this because, you know, that's not how Vladimir Putin operates. At least it wasn't how he operated in terms of Nemtsov. Nemtsov was, I think I saw a comment, he was a nobody. He wasn't a political threat to Putin. I mean, the interesting thing about the West is we tend to say, you know, he was the opposition. You can't really be the opposition if you can't compete. You know, if you wanted to say that the Communist Party is an opposition, you know, they score 20+ percentage points in the vote every year. So yeah, they are an opposition. There might be other opposition parties that can be built up. Nemtsov wasn't one of them. Was he as corrupt as Navalny in terms of, you know, working on behalf of the West? Probably not. Nemtsov was a political entity in his own right. You know, he's somebody who, you know, served in the Russian government and, had some influence. So he didn't need the West to buy his, resume, so to speak, but he was pro-West. He was leaning towards the West. He was trying to do the policies of the West, which were designed to undermine Russia. So many people could view him as being anti-Russian, but he wasn't a political threat to Vladimir Putin. Vladimir Putin didn't fear him at all. And his murder was tragic, and it was murder. But Vladimir Putin had nothing to do with it. That's my understanding.
Blame it on Putin.
And I will say this. You're probably going to accuse me of soften it up. I didn't use the name of the Chechen person because it's not hard fact. I mean, this is an understanding, and I'm not going to throw that name out there because I don't want people to run off and say, well, Scott Ritter said so-and-so was the guy behind it. It's my understanding that somebody did something, but you know, I'm not going to slander any individual by putting their name out there unless I know 100% certain that that individual was indeed doing it.
Good for you, Major. I agree. It's always good to clarify your level of certainty. Sometimes we have an impression. Sometimes we're somewhat certain. Other times we're very certain, like that the Supreme Court decided Citizens United correctly, as an example. Buldak from Quebec, at what rank of either military or civilian leadership does one typically see the true full picture of available manpower and casualties? Surely, if the secret is kept too high, lower officers may make grave mistakes as they work under limited or false information.
Let me break it to you, Buldak. The more senior you are, the less you know. You are so far removed from the nuts and bolts of what's going on. The people that know are the analysts, the people who collect the raw data. Their job is to collect the raw data, and they will write reports. Then those reports work their way up the chain of command. Mid-level management don't write reports. Mid-level management edits reports. They receive the reports from the lower people, and then they edit it based upon the political guidance from their senior management. And then once they massage it, they send it up to senior management, and then senior management takes this data and then condenses it into sound bites and feeds it to the decision makers. The decision makers know nothing, literally nothing. They only know what they're told by people after information has been filtered through. The person that knows the most is the most junior person in that thing. The junior analyst who collects the raw data and assembles it into that initial report. They're the ones that know the most.
Is that a Bob Dylan t-shirt you're wearing?
It is. It's a Bob Dylan concert t-shirt from the last time I saw Bobby in concert. Oh, I'm wearing it just to whet your appetite.
Consider me saturated. You know,
I'm going to have to get a new Bob Dylan t-shirt in about a week's time, I think.
Yeah, I think you would look good if you were to have a Dylan-esque hairdo like his. Can you bring that up a little bit? Let's see if the audience can weigh in on this. Can you imagine Scott with a hairdo like that?
No, but hell no.
Enough of this Marine shtick. Let's bring out the...
Look, I already got a hippie thing going, man. Just be happy with it.
All right.
My Mike Marshall. I used to get a number 3, if anybody knows what that, you know, in the... When they ask
that's
you what
that's the third shortest.
Yeah, number 1 is basically a razor all the way down.
Yeah, yeah, the shortest, right?
Then you got 2, and I used to get a 3, which was pretty skin up there. My wife is now, she won't let me do anything lower than a 5, which means I get a haircut, and then 2 weeks later I need another haircut. It's very irritating.
Sounds like she would like the Dylan look on you. Remember, Scott, a happy wife makes for a happy life.
I don't think she'd like the Dylan look. I think she likes this maybe a little bit. She's already telling me it's a little long. I tell you, she's very specific. It's got to be a 5. And then about a week later, she's like, you need another haircut. I said, well, want me to go to a 4? Nope, 5.
All right. Mike Marshall in Houston, Texas. Given that Hezbollah has more than enough rockets and missiles to accomplish the mission, is there a practical reason, Scott, why they wouldn't just take out every Israeli airstrip in the country? Wouldn't that prevent Israel from using jets to bomb and retaliate? Am I missing something? Asks Mike.
Well, you're missing the fact that Israel has Jericho missiles. And if Hezbollah were to nullify the Israeli Air Force, which isn't going to happen, by the way, they will do damage to certain airfields that complicate the Israeli, but there will be enough airplanes left and enough other strike capable systems to destroy Beirut, to destroy Lebanon. And that's what Hezbollah wants to prevent. Hezbollah is a political party that is committed to governance in Lebanon. not just in southern Lebanon, not just amongst the Shia population that Hezbollah, is born of, but also other Shia. The Amal movement is a Shia movement that Hezbollah is now responsible also for governing, the Sunni, the Christians. Hezbollah thinks about the Lebanese nation, and so they're not going to sacrifice the Lebanese nation to get a military advantage unless they're given no other choice. Now, if it comes down to where they have to go to war against Israel, then of course they will do what they want to do. But they need to be able to justify their decision to strike Israel to the Lebanese people, not just the Shia of southern Lebanon, but the Lebanese population. And the Lebanese population needs to understand and agree with the Hezbollah motives. And so that's why we don't see any precipitous actions on the part of Hezbollah.
The next question is from Marco in Croatia. Why did Truman cancel Navy and supercarriers in 1949? This question is for fun and to see the vastness of Scott's historical knowledge. Let's have some fun on Super Tuesday.
Marco, I don't know. Okay, I really don't. So, I mean, 1949, let's think about it. 1949, supercarriers.
I should have done what I did for the bonus army. I had the answer ready for you, but I figured you'd know.
I would imagine that there is some, budgetary constraints, reductions, priority. Forrestal was the Secretary of the Navy then. Marco, I got to go back and I got to look into that. So I apologize.
All right.
You just exposed me as somebody who doesn't. You ever play a game? You don't know Jack,
stump the inspector. Maybe that should be the new name of the show.
Well, he just stumped me. He gets a prize.
That's right. Jason from Tennessee, is the Russia-Ukraine war one of the most lopsided wars in history? Another historical query, as it were.
I wouldn't say so. I mean, it's gone on for more than 2 years. So one can't call it lopsided. Lopsided is, the German defeat of France in 1940. Lopsided is the Israeli defeat of Egypt, Jordan, and Syria in 1967. Lopsided is the American defeat of Iraq in 1991. Those are lopsided victories. This thing's gone on for 2 years. No matter how inevitable Russian military victory was, no one can ever take away the fact that Ukraine has resisted, defended, and done a good accounting for itself. Now, you want to talk about casualties? Yes, the Ukrainians have suffered horrific casualties, but if we're talking 7-to-1 casualty figures is the overall ratio, and we're saying they suffered 700,000 dead, as some people are suggesting, that's 100,000 dead Russians. It ain't that lopsided. A lot of dead Russians are being factored in here. So, it's not a lopsided. It's taken 2 years. We'll see what happens in the end. But no matter what, I do think that if you factor in the collective aspect of it, meaning that Russia's not just fighting Ukraine but all of NATO through a proxy conflict, that the Russian victory is very impressive, very impressive victory, but I wouldn't call it one of the most lopsided victories in history.
All right, let's take a phone call coming in live. Hello there, lower your device, please. You're on with our favorite weapons inspector on Super Tuesday. You must be so excited.
Oh, yeah, definitely. So excited.
Calm yourself or we'll tranquilize you.
Good afternoon, guys. This is Hussein from Bahrain calling in, asking if Israel could ever recover from this politically or economically in every way possible, or is the country just demolished, basically destroyed?
All right. Thank you for calling from Bahrain. It's hard to believe a guy in Bahrain isn't that excited about Super Tuesday. Thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it.
Well, first of all, I know I only got 3 minutes, but Bahrain is near and dear to my heart because from 1991 until 1998, every every inspection team but one that I led into Iraq, though even that one went through Bahrain. We had our United Nations headquarters there. We trained the teams in Bahrain. We debriefed the teams in Bahrain. So I spent a lot of time in Bahrain. So I have, like I said, it's near and dear to my heart. So thanks for bringing back those memories. Now I've wasted 30 seconds on that question, on that aspect of it. But the question was, do I think Israel will recover from this? I personally believe that Israel won't recover from this. I think Israel has been inflicted a fatal wound on itself. I think while they may stabilize their economy, the world has turned on Israel. I mean, the only friend they have out there anymore is the United States, and the United States is already finding out that we can't afford to be Israel's friend much longer. Israel will have to make changes that it doesn't want to make, and I think the pressure will be put on Israel that they will have to accept a two-state solution at a bare minimum, and this will create problems in Israel. I think you're going to see flight from Israel. I think that people are already leaving Israel. I think one of the political compromises Israel is going to have to make is deals with settlements, and I think you'll see that these settlers who have been stealing land, Israel will have to remove them like the cancer that they are. And this will cause huge problems within Israel politically. And more people will leave Israel. And I think you're going to see a depopulation of Israel, down the road. And I think you're going to see the empowerment of the Palestinians. And I just think Israel has done itself a huge disservice in the way that they've carried out this war. So.
Okay. We have another phone call. Hey there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hello. This is Chris from Canada. I was wondering about, China. You know, how their technology is so far advanced with that, I think it's called Borium or Scott, no, but how they're converting their nuclear power. It's like where they got supposedly 100 years or 20,000 years of energy and reserves. And I was wondering, is that like why the U.S. has fallen behind in like the technology race, just because I think they sell too many bombs and then they forgot about the big picture? I was just wondering if you could elaborate on that and what he knows about it.
All right. Good question and very well put. Thank you for calling, Chris.
Well, I can't get into the technical details of China's nuclear program, to be honest, because I think the last time I looked at it was 3 years ago, maybe 4 years ago. I was asked to look into a special kind of nuclear reactor that operated in a different way than the current nuclear reactors do, and that China and India had taken the lead in this, and these reactors produced no minimal nuclear waste and things of that nature. I can't get the name right now. It's on the tip of my tongue, but I can't remember. But what I will say is this. One of the reasons why the Chinese have an advantage is that they have the state is able to put an emphasis on doing targeted research, and the state will fund it so that the research doesn't have to be profitable. Here in the United States, it's very few companies that will undertake extensive research into something unless they, have a market plan down the road for it, or they're getting government funding. And so, while we do have very good technology here, it tends to be project driven, whereas the Chinese tend to be, concept driven. The other thing is, remember, we got 340 million people here in America. The Chinese have 1.4 billion people. And so it's just, look, if Jeff and I got together and we're going to do something, and we're pretty clever guys, we're going to do a plan here. There's two of us, And then there's another group of people that are going to do the same thing, but they can put 10 people on the project, 10 really good people. I would imagine that the 10 people are probably going to be able to come up with better ideas. Plus, if Jeff and I said, well, we can only limit our ideas to what is marketable on Ask the Inspector and within the framework of how we sustain ourselves. And the other 10 people went, oh, we got a blank check. We can party at the Hilton. We can go swimming in the pool. We can drink beer. We do whatever we want as long, you know, and we can accomplish it. They're not bottom line derived. They're going to do well. And I think that's one of the things the Chinese have is the ability to put more resources on a problem and not be linked to the need to turn an immediate profit.
All right. You just barely beat the clock. Good work, Major. The clock is paying off. Looking for feedback on this from the audience. Scott says he likes the clock. So unless the audience erupts in some kind of a mad, massive revolt, I think we're going to keep using it. Also, I got some feedback. See, I'll spare the audience my highly unlettered opinion about the Secret Service officer who aimed his gun at Aaron Bushnell. But I do look at the audience feedback in general. Sometimes it's hard to tell if three or four people say something. Does that mean the majority of the audience feels that way or just those three or four people? It's hard to tell sometimes. But some people were complaining about the phone call, Scott. They say they don't like it. They find it hard to hear, hard to understand what the people are saying. And they find it amazing that you can understand what they're saying. And sometimes when somebody has an accent, you know, a very thick accent, I have trouble understanding it too. And I also am surprised that you can hear it. But I think that most people like the phone calls. That's my suspicion because it's more actual interaction with Scott. And I look at Spaces on X, which is popular, and that's a jumbled mess with all the people they do there. Ours is much more controlled and limited. People have been taking phone calls on talk radio for years. It's very popular. So I suspect most people want it, but I see some people have been complaining about it. Should we take another phone call, Scott?
Why not?
Hello there. You are most welcome to join us, even if you have an accent. You're on with our weapons inspector.
Hi, this is Jody, and I've been following you guys ever since I found you. I need to ask, please, how familiar is he with George Soros' ties to the Ukraine and his financial activity in the Ukraine? And I just want to make the statement that during the 2020 COVID pandemic, guess where George Soros ended up in? He went to the Ukraine. Anyhow, I would appreciate any information you have. Thank you so much.
Okay, Joe. Well, thank you. Thanks for the call. No accent, but she was cutting out a little bit, but you could hear that, right?
I heard that, yes. There was a heavy American accent there, though. It was difficult to work my way through her American accent. But no, Jody, first of all, thank you for the call and thank you for your support. George Soros has been heavily involved in Ukraine for some time now. If you go back and take a look in the 1990s, Soros was already involved in this democratization aspect of it. He was a heavy funder of Ukrainian social movements leading up to the Color Revolution. And he has been, you know, investing money in the so-called Ukrainian Democratic Project ever since. And the fact that he flew to Ukraine sort of during the pandemic, is that what you said, sort of shows where his that he feels comfortable being there because he has invested so much into it. And so the Russian victory in Ukraine is going to be a devastating defeat for George Soros and his project. It'll be one of the first major reversals of it. No, he has heavily invested in regime change activity in Russia as well. And he hasn't succeeded, but where Soros money has resulted in a color revolution and the removal of one government replaced by one that Soros gives a stamp of approval, the Russian victory in Ukraine will be the first major reversal of the Soros project.
All right. For those of you who prefer your question in text format, now it's your time to enjoy Ask the Inspector. Here we go. Mita Kalikov from Malmo, Sweden. Why do you think President Putin said in the interview with Tucker Carlson that Poland is to blame for the war by not negotiating with Hitler?
Well, I think he was talking about the Danzig corridor. Danzig today is a city known as Gdansk, I believe. The Danzig corridor was created at the end of World War I when the Polish state was created to give Poland access to the sea. And it split Germany in half. You had East Prussia now, and then you had the rest of Germany. And the Germans were unhappy about this and felt that it had been foisted on them by, from a weakened position. And I think Adolf Hitler was saying that we need to, that Danzig is German, the Danzig corridor is German, and we're going to reverse this, and we'd like to talk to you about it. And the Poles said, absolutely not. We refuse to talk about this. And this led towards a path of confrontation. And I think what Putin was implying is that when you're a nation that is holding a weak hand, you sort of write your own obituary when you refuse to negotiate with a stronger power who's holding a strong hand. And I think that's what he was alluding to.
Next
question.
You
can disagree with him. You could disagree with him all you want. I'm not sitting here saying that he's correct. I'm not sitting here saying that Poland should have bowed down. But I think what Putin is saying from a historical perspective, Poland sealed its own fate by refusing to negotiate with Germany about the Danzig corridor. That's what he was saying.
All right. There was a false ending there, as we call it, in the business. And by the business, I mean the industry. Showbiz.
Which industry?
Showbiz.
The biz. Okay.
The biz, right. Brian Welbrock from Florida. Do you see Armenia becoming a new Ukraine? Is the U.S. using Armenia not to fight a war, but to be attacked, to try and light a fire on Russians and Iran periphery? For all my sympathies for Armenia, I find they have nobody to blame but themselves.
Well, you're right, Brian. What's happening right now, Pashinyan, I believe is the way you say the prime minister's name. He has put Armenia in a horrible position. First of all, by refusing to negotiate in good faith. Again, here we come, guys. When you're holding the bad hand and, you know, the other side says, let's negotiate this thing out. You know, the Armenians could have maintained some sort of Armenian autonomy in Nagorno-Karabakh, which is an enclave that was previously a majority population of Armenians inside Azerbaijan, which means legally speaking, it's Azeri territory. In 1993, 1994, the first Nagorno-Karabakh war was fought, and Armenia, together with the Armenians of Nagorno-Karabakh, not only declared the autonomy, independence from Azerbaijan. Armenia didn't absorb it, but they recognized that it was separate from Azerbaijan. They conquered about 15-20% of Azeri territory to make linkage to Nagorno-Karabakh. And then they refused for almost two decades to negotiate. There was a Minsk. Minsk always seems to be the city that people go to for these things. There was a Minsk negotiation, round of negotiations, as Azerbaijan wanted their territory returned. And if Armenia had been smart, they would have returned the territory for Azeri concessions on the autonomy of Armenia, on Nagorno-Karabakh, but they didn't. They held strong. Then they started playing games with Russia. And I mean, you don't leave the Russian president standing on the tarmac when he arrives in Yerevan to meet you. You don't leave him there and then expect good things are going to happen. And he, you know, started turning to the West, and Turkey slapped him down. 2020, big war, recaptured vast majority of the territory. Last year, Azerbaijan, basically took control of Nagorno-Karabakh. And right now, Pashinyan is seeking to pivot to the West. He's buying into false notions of support from America and France and others. They're not going to support him. They will abandon him. They're using him to create crisis in the Southern Caucasus. And at the end of the day, I happen to agree with Margarita Simeon, the editor of RT, who just spoke at a youth conference in Sochi, I believe, maybe in Kazan. I can't remember, maybe Kazan. But she said that in 5 years, Armenia will no longer exist. And I agree with her. If Pashinyan remains in power and continues to do these suicidal policies, in 5 years, Armenia will be absorbed by Azerbaijan, by Turkey, by others, but it won't exist as a modern nation state.
All right, we have another phone call coming in. Hi there, you're on with our favorite weapons inspector. What's on your mind?
Hello, how are you?
If you're talking to me, fine, thank you. Scott, how are you?
Oh, I'm good. Doing great, thanks.
How are you, Scott?
I'm doing great, thanks.
Thanks for all the work you do. You had to be beside yourself with George Galloway's victory this week. My God, that was great news. Anyway, first of all, there is no development in Chinese thorium reactors that's groundbreaking. These energy announcements that we hear once in a while, like Europe doesn't need Russia's gas anymore, all these things are just propaganda to, you know, sort of make investors and people at the top think twice. There's no burst out new nuclear technology. But my question is, they say the Ukrainian government could collapse. If Polish troops are sent in to just to stabilize the government, which is what I've kind of heard might happen, or NATO troops, if Ukrainians are fighting back or trying to topple their government, let's say, will Polish troops shoot Ukrainian people and Ukrainian soldiers? Would they even follow that order?
It depends on the conditions in which Poland is coming in. If Poland's invited by the Ukrainian government to intervene to stabilize the Ukrainian government, and the Ukrainian government is supported by a certain faction of people in Poland of sufficient quantity, then the Poles. But do the Poles really want to get involved in a civil war in Ukraine? I don't think so. And the other thing is Russia, Lukashenko, the head of Belarus, says he just simply won't tolerate Polish troops in Ukraine. So the moment they come in, Belarus will, together with Russia, intervene and destroy whatever troops are brought in. And Poland knows this. So I really don't see Polish troops being committed to this. Interesting map that Medvedev put up at the youth festival in Russia. It showed Russia taking over the vast majority of Ukraine beyond the four oblasts that I considered are inevitable to be taken over, Odessa, Mykolaiv, Dnepropetrovsk, and Kharkov. They showed them taking over four additional ones. And it also showed that Western Ukraine was carved up and given to Poland. It showed Hungary took a chunk, Romania took a chunk, and all was left is this little rump state called Ukraine in the middle. If that's really the Russian position, then that means that Russia at some point in time in its endgame strategy will work with Belarus to yield that area willingly to Poland as part of a negotiation. And this makes sense, to be honest, because the Banderists who come out of Western Ukraine are despised in Poland. And one way to denazify Poland might be, or to denazify Western Ukraine might be, to say to the Poles, here's your chance. These are the guys that did the Volyn massacre. They're right there, unapologetic. Do what you need to do. We'll step back. But I don't see Poland going into Western Ukraine without the consent of Russia. So that's that. I think I answered all. And I would just thank you for bringing up thorium reactors, because that was the thing that I had the paper on. And I agree with you. I don't see any breakout. I'm not a nuclear reactor specialist. I inspected for nuclear weapons, which gives me a passing knowledge of things nuclear, but I'm not. I did do a deep dig into the viability of thorium reactors and their competitiveness. But again, that's like 4 years ago, and I haven't kept up on the technology the way I probably should have. So thanks for giving me that name, and now I know what kind of reading I'm going to be doing tonight.
All right. Well, speaking of deep dig, Scott, I did a deep dig this past week because we didn't really give a definitive answer to the question about why Nikki Haley is referred to as a Waffle House waitress. your guess wasn't bad. It wasn't bad because she's kind of a flip-flopper, which is almost like waffling. But I found that the origin of that is when Trump appointed her as the UN ambassador, they were mocking her because she wasn't, in the opinion of the people mocking her, wasn't qualified. And so they were calling her, apparently she did used to work as a Waffle House waitress, and they were referring to her in that way, in the same way people sometimes refer to AOC as a bartender, because she was, in fact, a bartender. So there you have it.
There you go.
Sometimes you're not the only one who follows up on the asterisks, Scott. I thought I'd lighten your load a little bit and work on that for you.
I appreciate it. I really do.
All right. Now, another important matter is that we are now offering for sale women's cut of the two T-shirts, the Ask the Inspector T-shirt and Knowledge is Power. And I noticed that our own Yelena bought a T-shirt, and we would have given it to you, Yelena. We would have given it to you. Let's get Yelena in here. We would have given it to you. Why'd you buy it? Your microphone's not on, darling.
I decided to support waging peace, so I bought a T-shirt.
Which one did you buy?
I bought Knowledge is Power because I have asked the inspector already. I wanted a new one.
All right. Will you model it for us after you get it so we can you have somebody we actually know? All right.
Very sure. Good.
And just I think Yelena made a very important point here. Just to give you an example, I don't want to get too far ahead on the schedule, but Jeff may be going to Russia this summer in June to take Ask the Inspector on the road, Paruski. But to do this, isn't free. And the Ask the Inspector enterprise is going to be paying for this, so people who say that would be a great idea, we do it by funds that come in. And so there's some people out there that, and I'm a little defensive on this, Jeff, no, this is why I'm saying this, but they're like, oh, you're trying to, you're supposed to be out here talking about geopolitical stuff and informing us and all, but all you're trying to do is you're a grifter. You're trying to make money. Well, hell yeah, I'm trying to make money. A, I got to pay bills. B, we're trying to do some interesting stuff like make a movie, self-publish a book, things of that nature. And C, do things like take Ask the Inspector to Russia, which would, again, further the waging peace concept and also, I think, open us up to new audiences and provide an educational forum for non-Russian audiences. But it can't happen on its own. So when we sell T-shirts, when we sell coins, when we sell stuff like that, it's to raise money in support of these causes. It's not to, the Norman Ritter show, the lifestyle of the rich and famous. I mean,
although my weekly pedicures aren't cheap, but I understand it's not the priority.
Jeff, I how many times I told you not to talk about weekly pedicures when we're talking about selling T-shirts, but
what you're saying is Yelena should have bought more than one T-shirt. Come on, Yelena.
I'm saying, Yelena, if you're going to do this, go big. Okay. Go big or go home. No, I'm saying that, A, Yelena shouldn't have bought it. We would have given it because Yelena's part of the team.
There's the URL right there, scottrittermerch.com. The audience can buy it.
When you do buy a T-shirt, the money that's generated goes into an operational fund that's used to do things like, take Jeff to Russia, for instance. Maybe someday we might go to China, and it would help us go to China. So these the money's used for good causes, not just to buy Jeff expensive wine or to buy me Diet Coke, although
not just.
I'm not saying it doesn't.
All right. All right. Well, this actually costs us money, not a lot, but we pick up the shipping costs when we give away shirts, coins, whatever we give away. But that's all right. You're our beloved audience.
Damn right.
you deserve it. So it's about time to do the drawing. Whomever wins, whether you're a male or a female, what we're offering is one of the women's shirts. So if you're a guy,
well, let's see if we can get up to 250. 250. Come on, right. We can't give away a T-shirt without 250 people wanting a T-shirt.
That's
right. There's got to be 250 husbands out there that want to give their wives this great looking t-shirt. Knowledge
is Scott, powerful. you know it is Super Tuesday, so a lot of our normal regular viewers are probably out voting right now.
They're out voting, of course, but six more and we're at the 250 mark. And then one more will put us over. Boom, Jeff,
all right, hit the button. We are at it. All right, let's do the drawing.
Another YouTube winner. Thank you. I'm telling you, YouTube.
That's all right. Congratulations to IGI. We demand equality. No, I don't think this app works on Rumble, even though we were originally told it does. So I don't know what to do about that. But we actually should figure out some way to show them some love over there on Rumble.
We have to show Rumble some love. We got to do something here, man. You know, we're pushing
Rumble.
All right,
Yelena, let's make a point of talking about that in the coming days. Let's figure out how to do something for our beloved Rumble people. Okay. All right, so that'll do it for this week's episode of Ask the Inspector. I want to remind folks that Scott has a new article out on Substack, The Silent Eulogy. Maybe you'll take it as a...
And Navalny Part 2 coming soon to a theater near you.
No comment.
Jeff, I had a really difficult last couple of days, so the time that is normally allocated to things was not allocated. We had to take two trees down on an emergency basis in our front yard. So
all right, I have to change my no comment to a comment now, but you said it was done. How much time do you need to just hit the send button if it's really done?
Well, it was done, Jeff, but I'm a professional. And I continue to rewrite new sources, and I found two new sources that I have to read, absorb, and see how they're going to be integrated into this paper, because there's a lot of people are going to read this thing. And if I don't have my dots dotted, my I's dotted, my T's crossed, it looks bad. I'm not going to put bad product out there. So I'm sorry.
I understand. I'm not nearly as talented or as prolific as you are, but I have done some writing and I understand how you look at something and you feel like it might be finished, and then you realize, no, it's not finished. And it's hard to...
Well, my problem is I just keep reading, and then I go... And then you find that thread, and you just keep pulling the thread, and you go, ooh, you keep pulling. And next thing you know, boom. I do want to tag shirt with Maverick photo for my dog. If we can get enough people interested in that, we will put Maverick out there. He is the head of security, and he's kept me alive so far, because there are Ukrainian hit teams out there wandering the earth looking for me, and Maverick keeps me safe.
And we may have some products for sale with Maverick too. I spent almost all of yesterday afternoon interviewing people who responded. Remember, I asked for help with the website. Well, I did get a nice response. Some very talented people got in touch. Also, a couple of very talented artists, including somebody who can do caricatures, Scott.
Yes, because we're going to come up with an Ask the Inspector roadshow for Russia. What do we call it? A logo. Logo, that's it. Logo.
Caricature. So, a caricature.
Well, it'll be right. Three caricatures, but we're going to assemble them in some sort of logo that will... Anyways, yes. Thank you, Jeff. You're the best. And Yelena, you're the best, too. Maverick, you're the best. Everybody's the best. The audience is the best.
All right. Scott is dishing out the compliments today. That'll do it for the lightning round of Ask the Inspector. We do it every Tuesday at 3 p.m. Eastern time. Join us
Maverick
Friday
Karugian
night.
Was a question.
What's that?
I'm sorry. Some of these questions just crack me up. Is Maverick Peruvian? I mean, come on. He is short, but geez, guys, that's a racist thing. Maverick's a Pomeranian. That means he's German.
Oh, he heard you say his name.
Well, we got the UPS guy out here. It's going to get very loud pretty soon.
Thank you, Mole or Mole, however you say that. I appreciate that. We may need to see Maverick's papers to really determine his ethnicity. All right. As I was saying, join us Friday night for the loquacious version of Ask the Inspector at 8 p.m. Eastern time. Thank you, Yelena. You are the best.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We appreciate you very much. And thanks to our beloved audience. Thanks to you, Scott, as well. Look forward to getting together again on Friday night. Till then, take care, everybody.